There's been growing poverty in our suburbs for years. WBEZ Chicago and the Better Government Association have spent months talking to people in one of those communities, Dalton, Illinois. Here's real estate broker Anton Sharp.
The main thing that's bringing this area down is that I paid $100,000 for a house in 2000, and now it's worth $50,000. People used to carry their wealth in their home. A house is the best investment you could have. Not anymore.
Plus, Starved Rock and Matheson State Parks are expanding by more than 2,600 acres. What that means for visitors and for the land itself. And the next Congress will have 7 new members with science backgrounds. We'll speak with current representative and physicist Bill Foster about what this could mean for the next few years. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a jam-packed program for you today. Later, we'll be speaking to some of the new crop of scientists in Congress. That's not just longtime Congressman Bill Foster, the only PhD physicist, but also Congressman-elect Sean Casten will be joining us. And we'll be talking about the expansion of a few state parks, including Starved Rock. But first, when you think of the suburbs, what comes to mind? Maybe you grew up in one, maybe you live in one now, and perhaps you associate them with safety, community, and prosperity. And when we tend to think of poverty, we associate that with cities. Remember the term inner city? What does it look like to be poor when you live in the suburbs? What kind of services are available? Miles Bryan from WBEZ Chicago and Casey Toner from the Better Government Association have spent the past few months diving into the issue of poverty as it affects one particular Illinois suburb. That's Dalton. Located on the south side of Chicago, Dalton has undergone massive social and economic changes when we look at the past 50 years. And how can that be an example of the suburbanization of poverty? Both Miles and Casey are with us now to tell us more from WBEZ Studios in Chicago. Miles, Casey, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having us.
We've also got Elizabeth Kneebone with us. She's the research director at UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation. She's also with the Brookings Institute. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome. Thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Casey, I wonder if we could start with you. When we say the suburbs, I think we, lots of people have a certain image in their head, right? And your story focuses on Dalton. I wonder, first of all, what led you to wanting to cover this issue in Dalton?
Well, it could have been Dalton, and it could have been Cal City. It could have been Harvey. It could have been Riverdale. It could have been any number of these suburbs that are on the southern edge of the city of Chicago that grew to prominence in this age of industry and manufacturing. But with the decline, I've also experienced a lot of woes and a lot of poverty. And so we picked Dalton and we went from there.
And Miles, when we think about the decline of manufacturing, I wonder what impact the closure of things like Wisconsin Steel, Southworks, other manufacturing giants had on Dalton specifically.
Yeah, I mean, Dalton and in this whole region were driven by those sorts of jobs. I mean, it was a story that I think you could write as basically, white folks leaving the south side of Chicago, often fleeing black residents, moving into south side Chicago neighborhoods and ending up in these inner ring south suburbs, and then having these great middle class jobs, as you said, at steel mills and at other manufacturing areas for a long time. And that sort of powering this strong middle class that kept these communities really vibrant for many years until they started to decline.
Elizabeth, Miles and Casey have been talking about this ring in the south suburbs of Chicago, but in many ways, I wonder how much you think this reflects other communities, not just across Illinois, but the Midwest, particularly when it comes to suburban poverty.
Dalton definitely isn't alone, nor are the south suburbs of Chicago. This really is a national trend that we've seen particularly rapidly changing since 2000. The suburban poor population have grown at a faster pace than the poor population in cities or in rural areas. And in fact, we actually passed a tipping point in the early part of the 2000s where there are now more people living under the federal poverty line in suburbs than in cities, than in rural communities or areas that we more traditionally associate with poverty. A number of these communities are these older inner ring suburbs in you know, Rust Belt, formerly manufacturing heavy communities that have seen that restructuring of the economy, the decline of those types of jobs and industries. But poverty is touching a lot of other suburbs as well, you know, in the northwest part of mm-hmm. Chicago, on the west side of Chicago, and across the country. It really is increasingly a suburban phenomenon to see poverty growing and spreading beyond the central city.
And if I could just piggyback off that for a minute, I mean, I think we often see a narrative in the media of, oh, these are these places that declined with the decline of manufacturing, and they never really recovered. And these are, you know, often sort of frustrated communities that might have, you know, voted for Trump in the 2016 election. But I think Elizabeth Niebone's work has been really brilliant in sort of pointing out that this has been this sort of across-the-board struggle for suburbs, especially in the last 15 or 18 years or so. It's not necessarily something that just, you know, you can just locate in the 1970s. It's been a much more recent phenomenon.
Right. And I think, Elizabeth, then that also then brings in the recession as well. And you can't talk about the recession without talking about housing. And Miles, I wanted to ask you about that because housing is another big issue in Dalton. You all were talking about just the migration patterns and what you all see. And I think what happened in Dalton mirrors a lot of places. In the 80s and 90s, you had many white residents moving out after African-Americans started moving in. And at that time, many people blamed the problems on African-Americans coming from the city. Nowadays, it's kind of a similar thing where it's just the newest people are getting blamed for the problems, right? So many Dalton residents blame renters for the problems with the housing market. And I wanted to play a little bit of a conversation, Miles, you had with talking to resident Willie Cotton Jr. and Alicia Moses about renters in Dalton.
There's a very few homeowners here.
Why does that matter, you know?
Well, a homeowner usually have an investment. Renters, they really don't have an investment.
They come out here and they don't treat it as their own. It's like in the city. It's like they brought the city out here.
Yeah, so you hear there the two residents of Dalton who both bought homes there. These are African-American residents who bought homes in the 90s, you know, came out to live their sort of version of the suburban dream in this community and feel frustrated with these big declines they've seen, the increasing poverty, increasing lack of home ownership. I think the issue that this highlights to me, and I think Elizabeth's work touches on this, is that it can be really hard in these small communities, isolated communities that are dealing with these big systemic problems, to sort of see the forest for the tree from the trees necessarily, and be able to address the problems at the big systemic level they're happening. I mean, in Chicago, there's terrible poverty, there's terrible entrenched social issues, but there's also a lot of social services, there's a lot of, you know, folks sort of thinking at a high level about how to deal with these things systemically, and it's just a lot harder to do that in a small, poor community like Dalton, especially when Dalton's not, you know, working with its neighbors.
Miles, when you say systemic problems, I think, how does that get reflected in a place like Dalton? What are the problems that you're seeing? Is it a lack of home ownership? Is that a big one?
Yeah, I mean, so home ownership has been on the decline for years. I think a lot of it in Dalton comes out of the recession, right? I mean, this was a place where you could go and get a starter home and it would build some equity for you. And you could move up to a bigger one when you had another kid. And that sort of was this backbone of the village, but housing values went completely underwater since the Great Recession. They've recovered a bit, but they're not where they were in 2007. I mean, at the same time, because Dalton, this tiny community, doesn't have commercial properties, doesn't have a base the way that Chicago does to fund services through property taxes, the village has had to keep taxing its remaining residents more and more and more. So you have these really high property taxes. And it's just this sort of spiral that seems incredibly hard to get out of, that puts more and more pressure on the folks who are left. And then, you know, they want to leave too.
Yeah, and you have people in Dalton who own homes that could maybe sell for $40,000 or $50,000. And they are paying in taxes $6,000 a year. I mean, so these property taxes.
$6,000, Casey? $6,000 for a $40,000 house.
Yes. I mean, it's unbelievable. And, you know, right across the border in Chicago, the property tax rate is three times lower. And so it's just this, you know, wild contradiction of services and of taxes.
And so part of that, Casey, is because of, I feel like it's also hard to, you can't not talk about Dalton and not talk about the corruption part of this too, right? Because that's also a part of Dalton's story. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's affected the city's finances?
It's not just corruption, it's dysfunction. I mean, I went to a village board meeting in October where the microphones weren't working because the person that operated the microphones got laid off, so that the board members, the mayor, and the people in the crowd that were there to watch were yelling at each other, with a police officer who would stand up every once in a while and tell, you know, the people in the audience to keep down. But over the years, I mean, there's just all these kind of wild scandals that just keep on popping up. When we wrote about this former mayor, who's this kind of larger-than-life Chicago character who, you know, gave his son a $1 million contract to fix this retirement home that the community owns. And then the son pleaded guilty to tax fraud on it. And, you know, right now in the village, they're in this enormous hole because they owe the city of Chicago more than $7 million in unpaid water bills. And they had the money for the water bills, but then they transferred them to another fund so they could pay for government services. But now they owe the city of Chicago more than $7 million in water bills. And so what do you do like this when you're just strapped for resources?
That's Casey Toner with the Better Government Association. We're also talking to Miles Bryan from WBEZ Chicago and Elizabeth Kneebone, who's a research director at UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation. Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you just about how the Great Recession, I mentioned this earlier, how that affected suburbs like Dalton, how much it further damaged their chances at economic recovery and stability, as we've seen other areas of Illinois recover slowly, maybe, but certainly there's been more recovery in the past 10 years. That hasn't happened in Dalton?
Well, I think it's, you know, the recession really compounded and exacerbated sort of the groundwork that was already laid. Like, we had already seen poverty starting to grow in places like Dalton and other suburbs across the country. You know, we had the 2000s began with a recession that hit the Midwest and across the country and started to show the rise in poverty across cities and suburbs. You know, then you have a sort of a recovery that didn't reach down the ladder before the Great Recession hit. And we, this deep, protracted downturn, as you said, very much linked to the housing crisis, which was very suburban in its footprint, ended up really just pushing fast forward on this, the growth of poverty and the tilt of poverty towards the suburbs. But it really wasn't just about the recession. The recession really just sort of worsened conditions that communities were already starting to experience. And what we've seen in the recovery is that actually across the country, in Chicago, but in metro areas across the country, the cities are starting to show signs of recovery before suburbs, and many suburbs are sort of stuck. They really are in kind of a post-recession slump, where even though we're years into an economic expansion and recovery, it's not really being felt. It's not really touching some of these places that were so badly affected by the foreclosure crisis and all of the ripple effects of the recession. So you have the economic kind of cyclical effects. You have the restructuring of the economy in these places where they're losing middle-wage jobs, and maybe the jobs that they have just pay less than before, you know, more low-wage.
Or there aren't jobs, right?
Jobs. Or there aren't jobs, that's right. Or people who may be working, because, again, we're seeing unemployment rates start to recover, and, in fact, you know, unemployment rates that were we haven't seen since the boom of the 90s, and yet poverty has not returned to the levels that we were experiencing at that same time. It still remains sort of stuck above those rates, which I think says something about the fact that, you know, people may be working, but they're earning less before. They may want to work full-time, but they're not able to find those employment opportunities. So, again, there are a lot of factors that are working together to, you know, keep places like Dalton and its neighboring communities, you know, struggling.
Elizabeth, when I want to go back to something Miles said at the beginning, which is he talked about what poverty looks like in the city and how much more there is in infrastructure. Especially when you're thinking about a city like Chicago, there are even funding and foundations are focused on solving poverty within the city limits. How does that look different in the suburbs when it comes to an infrastructure of support to help people lift people out of poverty?
There really is a much thinner and patchier infrastructure in these places. For exactly the reasons you're talking about, you know, our public perception still thinks of poverty as an urban challenge or a rural challenge. And it is. You know, cities and rural communities continue to struggle with high poverty rates and continue to have challenges and need resources. But what hasn't kept up with the reality is our perception of poverty in the suburbs, and not just our perception, but our actual investments. So we see philanthropic dollars and federal and government dollars still disproportionately targeted to large city centers, even though now more poor live in the suburbs in Chicago and in many metro areas across the country. And part of the challenge is not just that the level of poverty in the suburbs, again, that rapid increase that we saw in suburban poverty in the 2000s, it's hard to catch up with something that happened so quickly and it was such a great magnitude. But it's also the fact that the suburbs themselves are these really, it's a fragmented landscape of communities. You know, the suburbs of Chicago, we say that like it's one thing, and we're talking about hundreds of communities and places like Dalton, who are just over 20,000 people, who are dealing with challenges that are regional, if not national, in scope. And they're just not equipped with the capacity or the local resources to address them. That makes it challenging to even apply for something like a federal grant or a state program that might help ameliorate these problems. Just being able to have the staff capacity to go after that money and implement it effectively, if you were able to get it, is much more challenging in these communities. And it's much harder to tackle these challenges one by one when we're really talking about a regional landscape of need.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll just finish up this conversation with Elizabeth Niebone from Brookings and UC Berkeley, Casey Toner with the BGA, and Miles Bryan from WBEZ. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. For tuning into The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about some reporting that WBEZ Chicago and the BGA have been doing about the Chicago suburb of Dalton. We will tweet out those stories if you follow 21ST Show. We've been talking to reporters Miles Bryan from WBEZ and Casey Toner with the BGA. Elizabeth Niebone is also with us. She's a research director at UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation. She's also with the Brookings Institute. Elizabeth, before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you one last question about something you said before the break. And you were just talking about how fragmented poverty can be in suburban areas. And it struck me as we were speaking that perhaps this is very similar to rural areas and rural poverty. And I'm not sure that we've necessarily figured out good solutions for that. But I wonder if you see that as something that's maybe we can apply solutions that we've looked at for rural poverty to suburban areas, and if we need to think about that from a policy perspective.
I actually think about it in a way that, you know, suburbs are sort of this overlapping space between the challenges we see in urban areas and rural communities. You're absolutely right, where rural and suburban communities often have in common is this lack of things like transit and transportation options, you know, a thin safety net, you know, fewer service providers, patchier services. But suburbs at the same time often experiencing or increasingly experiencing urban challenges like concentrated poverty, like very poor neighborhoods and more poor people living in very high poverty places. So if we can figure out a more effective way to address poverty in a suburban context, in many ways we're figuring out efficiencies and solutions that could better address poverty in both cities and rural communities. Because what we need when we think about the suburban context is to figure out this way to get to a more effective scale of addressing these issues, being able to cross jurisdictional boundaries, being able to integrate across service areas, and to really target the sort of multifaceted needs that poor residents face. And figuring out those deployment systems in a way that actually work better for suburbs is something that would benefit poor people across different kinds of community types.
Thanks for that, Elizabeth. That's Elizabeth Kneebone. I want to thank Casey Toner and Miles Bryan for being with me as well. Again, we'll tweet out their work on this. Thanks all of you.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks.
Thank you.
The newly elected members of the House of Representatives took their class photo last week, providing visual proof of the historic changes voters made during the midterm election. It includes more than 100 women, many women of color, a Muslim woman of color, a representative who wears hijab. That's a Somali American from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar. But something you can't see just by looking at an elected official is how many congressmen and women are scientists. And our next Congress will include 10 scientists, including several from Illinois. There's Lauren Underwood in the 14th District west of Chicago, a registered nurse who was appointed by President Obama as a senior advisor at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And Sean Kasten in Illinois' 6th District, also west of Chicago. He has degrees in molecular biology, biochemistry, and engineering management, and is president of Recycled Energy Development, a company that works to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And a veteran member of the House, Representative Bill Foster in the 11th District, an area that includes Naperville and part of Argonne National Labs. He also spent more than two decades as a physicist at Fermi National Accelerator, and right now is the only physicist, PhD scientist in Congress. Compare that with, by the way, six former talk show hosts who are members of Congress. Representative Foster and Congressman-elect Kasten are both on the line with us now. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here now.
Pleasure to be here now.
Congressman-elect Kasten, let's start with you. Before we talk about the science, I'm just wondering how your freshman orientation is going. Can you tell us what you've been learning?
Oh, boy. It is truly drinking from the fire hose. You know, you go from these moments of just unbelievable humility and patriotism, you know, sitting in the House where Steny Hoyer gathers us all around and says 12,000 people in history have had the job that you just received, and if that doesn't give you a lump in your throat, I don't know how you live with yourself. And then you have these other moments of just being, you know, totally overwhelmed and saying there's a lot of rooms in this building and I don't know how to get from point A to point B in time, and I'm glad that there's someone here in a red coat who's half my age and seems to know how to do things around here. But it's pretty neat and special, and as you said in your introduction, it is really neat to be part of just such an unbelievably diverse class on every measure. It's a neat group of people.
So I wanted to talk about the role of science in Congress. But Representative Foster, I wanted to start with you and ask you about President Trump's recent comments about climate change scientists. He said that climate change scientists had, quote, a big political agenda. Congressman Foster, you've been pretty open in responding, saying that's an unfortunate example of the president's inability to understand the importance of science. What do you think is the biggest misunderstanding the president has about science?
Well, it's not only the president that exhibits this behavior. You know, I've served on the Science Committee for several years now. And after the election of President Trump, the first hearing we had was entitled Making the EPA Great Again, which was just part of a pattern of climate change denial that we've seen in the witnesses, the hearings that were chosen, and a lot of the questions that we heard in the Science Committee for so long. I think if you Google my name, Bill Foster, and then the word Greenland, you're led to a story and a video where this Republican lawyer witness who was trying to convince us that it was a matter of scientific debate whether or not it was a good thing if the Greenland ice sheet melted. And so this is what we've been having to deal with. I am hoping that we will be able to get back to science and the Science Committee and also deal effectively with the fact that almost every issue we touch has a technological edge to it, and that there is no substitute for having technical expertise, which is why I'm so thrilled by the incoming class.
And I wonder, Representative Foster, I believe the last time you and I chatted was around the time that lots of scientists were saying that they were feeling under attack. I'm thinking in particular of the EPA. Do you think that the past 2 years, I wonder if you think this election will change things or change that attitude? Because certainly we've seen a lot of these anti-scientific attitudes for some time, not just in the past 2 years.
Well, I'm sure that we'll make them better. We will hopefully have it at a minimum effective oversight on the agencies that are being now led by political appointees with, frankly, non-scientific agenda. We've not had the head of the EPA in front of the Science Committee for the 2 years that we've been operating under President Trump, or the head of the Department of Energy, now who typically would come before the Science Committee to talk about the DOE science programs. And so this, I hope, will change at a minimum.
I'm sure both of you would also say that the rollbacks from the Obama administration's efforts to reduce carbon emissions have also been very damaging. And I wonder, with a divided government, as we're looking at a Democratic House and a Republican-controlled Senate, Mr. Kasten, what specific goals do you think you would like in terms of policy and law to see accomplished?
You are absolutely right that the urgency with which we need to address climate is vastly greater than I think what people think is politically possible right now. What I would hope from a policy perspective is the business that I ran for 16 years had a mission to profitably reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it was based on a real simple truism, which is that if you don't burn fossil fuel, you don't release CO2 and you don't have to buy fossil fuel. And there are a ton of opportunities for us to grow the economy, create jobs, build infrastructure, and lower CO2 emissions. And I don't just say that as a matter of theory. I say it because it's what I've done for 16 years. And politically, that conversation has been too often framed as an argument between the environment and the economy instead of one focused on the win-win. And, you know, number one, if you are not persuaded at all and that it would be a problem if the Greenland ice sheet melted, but you do want to have cheaper energy, I can probably find a way to work with you. And I would hope that good, reasonable people can work together. But as a separate matter, we've got a whole lot of issues that we are not dealing with because we haven't recognized this as a win-win that we should be. So, you know, for example, we've built a lot of wind and solar in this country in response to economic signals, not environmental drivers, over the last 10 years. The CO2 intensity of the U.S. power grid is down 30% in the last 15 years. That's awesome. But we've also built that generation in places where it doesn't have a clear transmission path to market. And as a result, a lot of utilities are installing resistor banks to dump excess electricity. That's a good problem to have, but it's still a problem. And I think putting people into positions of power who understand the science, who understand the economic opportunity, but also recognize that we still need to have smart policy that that does things the right way will hopefully be a step in the right direction.
That's Congressman-elect Sean Kasten from Illinois' 6th District, Democrat from Downers Grove, from Naperville, who Representative Bill Foster is also with us. Representative Foster, I just wanted to ask you about how you think being a scientist makes you think about other policy issues differently, even ones that aren't inherently scientific.
Well, before we go to that, I'd like to just add something to it. One of the big changes that's happened in the last couple of years is that the large international fossil fuel companies, you know, BP, ExxonMobil, and so on, who are largely run by engineers, they understand that global warming is real, and they have changed their policies so that they no longer oppose a price on carbon emissions, and this is fundamental. It has not been adopted by some of the U.S.-based fossil fuel companies, but I think that when we have a Congress with technical skills, engineering skills, real business credentials like Sean's, making contact with the businesses that exist to exploit fossil fuels, but can talk in scientific terms, then that is the bridge that I hope we can build to get a consensus. To sort of surround the climate change deniers with people that make systems that work and understand that our planet has to be a system that works as well.
So having make an economic argument, it sounds like both of you are saying, as opposed to focusing on the science.
That's right. And, as a scientist.
They're not inseparable.
Sorry, Mr. Kasten, did you say they're not inseparable?
I said those two things are not necessarily. One can be. There are good scientific reasons to help grow the economy, and there are good economic ways to support science and the environment. Those things all can work in synergy together, but you have to focus on the synergy.
And Representative Foster, back to being a scientist, I wonder if does that make you think about other policy issues differently when there are bills that come to the floor that demand some scientific understanding? Do your colleagues come to you for advice?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, very often. You know, this happens in national security situations like the debate over the Iran nuclear deal, where during that time, you know, Republicans, Democrats came to me. You know, if you actually look at the text of the Iran nuclear deal, they had a one-page table of reactor core specifications for the changes the Iranians had to make in their heavy water reactor to make sure that it could not be used to make large amounts of weapons-grade plutonium. And so Republicans and Democrats were coming to me and say, Bill, how do I vote on this, this table of reactor core parameters? And so those issues come up. There are also a number of issues where the engineers or the scientists' habit of attaching a rough number to a decision is a very valuable skill. Because if you look at bills that are brought up to save human lives, you know, typically they will have a cost, and typically they will have a number of lives that will be saved. And just making sure that we spend our money in the ways that are most effective at preserving human lives is sort of an engineer's or a scientist's look at legislation to make sure that our taxpayer dollars are spent the most effectively. And that sort of attitude, I think, is often missing in Congress, where we tend to be driven by anecdotes instead of data.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Kasten, just about the politics of getting elected, particularly when it comes to fundraising. And I would think from the outside, this might be something that's very foreign to a person in the science world. I wonder, do you think it's a hard challenge for scientists who are candidates to have to fundraise at the level that's expected in today's elections?
I have the blessing or the curse of having already gone through the transition, because I started out doing basic science and engineering and then got the entrepreneurial bug. And when I realized I was going to have to raise a couple hundred million dollars in order to do that, I sat there thinking, well, wait a minute, I just wanted to go build things. I didn't want to have to spend time asking people for money. And so I'd sort of done that in the entrepreneurial transition. I think the hardest thing for me to realize was that for whatever, you know, our campaign finance system has a lot of problems. It also has some things it does well. And one of the things it does well is it compels you to talk to a large number of people, because no one individual is allowed to write you a very large check. What that does practically is means that when I decided to run, and people said, you know, I think Bill was one of the first who told me, you're going to need to raise at least $5 million to really make sure you can win this. And I said, well, that's going to be easy. I raised a couple hundred million dollars before. It turns out it's actually a lot easier to raise $100 million from one person than it is to raise $5 million from 90,000 people. And it's a lot of time, and it's a challenge. And I'm pleased to see that the leadership in the House is talking about campaign finance reform as one of its early issues, because I think we are better as a society when we pay our legislators to study policy and understand the issues and talk with constituents. And we're worse as a society when we pay our elected members to make phone calls and ask for money. But in order to get to that better world, we need to reform the campaign finance system.
We just have a minute left. Representative Foster, just before we let you go, wanted to ask you about the next Speaker of the House. You're one of 15 Democrats who's pledged to vote against Nancy Pelosi in her bid to take the speakership again. Who would you like to see instead?
Well, this is a discussion that's been going on for, you know, frankly, more than a decade. You know, we have three leaders in the top three positions in leadership of the Democratic caucus that have been locked in place for the last 16 years. And this is not a healthy situation for any organization. And so, you know, because of the fact that we have, this issue has been raised with the top three leaders repeatedly without any resolution for a long time now, what's happening is that we're using the leverage that exists in the simple requirement that the Speaker of the House of Representatives needs to have the support of a majority of the members of the House of Representatives. And we're using that leverage to have some transparency and some clarity about the succession plan for for the leadership in the U.S. House. And that's the discussion that is being had, you know, mainly in private, partly in the press. And I'm hopeful there'll be a good resolution to that.
Well, thanks for that, Congressman. Afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank Representative Bill Foster, Congressman-elect Sean Casten. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you live here in Illinois, at one point or another, you've probably visited Starved Rock or Matheson State Park in Oglesby, and you're not the only one. Every year, millions of visitors pass through those parks. Now, both of them will be expanding by more than 2,600 acres. Last month, Governor Rauner announced an $11 million land acquisition from the private company Lone Star Industries. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with Starved Rock and Matheson State Park Site Superintendent Carrie Novak. But first, for years, college students in geology classes have used parts of that new land acquisition, a quarry, to collect and study fossils and samples. What might it mean for them now that the quarry will be part of the park? Mike Phillips is on the line with us. He's a geology professor at Illinois Valley Community College in Oglesby. Mike, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for inviting me on.
So, Mike, can you tell us about the quarry and how you as a geology professor use that for educational purposes?
Yeah, the quarry is an exposure of the rock that we call the La Salle Limestone, and it is the La Salle Limestone is kind of interesting rock formation because it's a combination of limestone, and it has a lot of thin layers of clay in it, which is one of the reasons why it was attractive to the Lone Star and the current or the recently previous owner. They made cement out of it. But to us, the clay layers, it turns out, have a lot of fossils in them, as does the limestone. But the clay layers have preserved the fossils in a very, very nice condition, and it makes it actually very easy to collect. So we would take students there to look at the layers of rock and then to kind of explore what was in those layers so that they could see kind of the history of the earth, and you get a real feel for that history when you can go up and kind of, you're basically walking on ancient ocean floor, and you can tell that's what it was because of all the fossil shells that are there.
That sounds really interesting, Mike, and it's not just you at Illinois Valley Community College. I know you mentioned UIC in Chicago, ISU in Bloomington are a couple, Northern Illinois University. Those are three universities that also bring geology students. What are you worried about now with this expansion in terms of your ability to collect from the quarry?
Well, we see this actually as an opportunity. So the company that owns it now stopped mining a few years ago, and when they did, then our access to the quarry, and usually field trips would go in there on the weekends when the quarry's not in operation, access stopped a few years ago when they stopped mining there. So what our hope is with the DNR owning the property, that can be opened up again to field trips, and we can start taking our students back there.
And how have you asked DNR about this yet?
We have SDNR, so I know your guest coming on next is Superintendent Carrie Novak. We've talked to him. We've talked to some folks in the land acquisition unit, and they told us that they're in what's called a plan of work process where they're deciding what to do with the property. And so that's why we actually prepared a request and sent it to Superintendent Novak and the DNR yesterday, asking that they consider setting aside part of the quarry as a place where we could use it kind of as a geological park and possibly collect fossils.
Well, Mike, thanks for joining us. It's Mike Phillips, a geology professor at Illinois Valley Community College. As you just said, he's part of a group that's petitioning DNR to ensure that this area stays open to students and for educational research. Mike, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you so much.
And Mike mentioned Carrie Novak, site superintendent for Starved Rock and Matheson State Parks, who's on the line with us now. Hi, Carrie. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on this morning.
So, Mike, it sounds like Mike, Carrie, one of Mike's petition to you is probably one of a lot of different requests you're getting in terms of the expansion. Have you heard other concerns or challenges from people about this expansion of the parks?
Yes, we have. we are going into a position, as Mike said, that through our plan of work process, through our and bringing in the our colleagues in the Office of Resource Conservation and Law Enforcement, and we're talking about law enforcement, conservation police. We're talking about natural heritage biologists, wildlife biologists, fisheries biologists, and we're going to be looking at this area, which is a total of 2,630 acres. And the first thing we have to do is get a feel for it, because, frankly, this kind of came upon us somewhat suddenly, and I'm not very familiar with most of this area. And since it was a quarry before, you know, it wasn't open to anybody to do anything, much less, as he said, you know, do your fossil collecting. But we're looking at, we're going to take some time and try to figure out what we can do with this. It's very challenging. If you want to know what's in there, I can give you some kind of a breakdown.
Sure, go ahead.
For timber acres, there's about 590 acres. For crop acreage, there's some farming in there. There's 313 acres. Water acreage is 91 acres, which there's a couple of small ponds, but I think most of this has to do with the Vermilion River area that's in there. And then the quarry property, there's 1,635 acres of that. So that all adds up to about 2,630 acres. And ironically, with this being added to Matheson, Matheson just became larger than Starved Rock.
Oh, that's interesting. So, Carrie, how, when we think about if you're farming, timber, quarry, incorporating that into a state park, what will that mean?
Well, it's going to be challenging. Again, this some of this area is spectacularly beautiful. The there's some you know really local spots that the Wildcat Rapids. There's an area called Bailey Falls. All that stuff down in there. It's wild and it's beautiful and. And that's going to be probably a great area for hiking and, you know, that kind of thing. There's a large area of quarry land, which is going to take a lot of work to do anything with, and probably a, you know, certainly having an area for, as far as education and everything else for fossil hunting will certainly be given every consideration on that. But it's you know, it's frankly, it's going to be very challenging as to what we're going to do that because, you know, overall, we'd like to offer some picnicking. We'd like to offer a nice area for camping. It's probably access is going to be a problem because of, you know, it's going to be coming in mostly through the city of Oglesby and, so access is going to be a problem, and you know, but we have to get in there. And there being a quarry, there's a lot of safety concerns. There's you know a lot of cliffs and things like that where you know we don't want people to fall off of. Also, the
so Carrie, what's the time frame for when this new land will be incorporated into the park and when it will be open? It sounds like
frankly,
this is
I think
it's going to be a couple of years.
Oh, easy a couple of years. I think it's going to take us a couple of years to get into, you know, just the idea of what we're going to do. And then you get into where, you know, you're going to have to get engineers in and engineering and site planning and start trying to figure up, you know, what's going to go where. Like I said, the access is going to be a problem. We may have to construct an additional bridge over the river, which would be, you know, very expensive, but right now, there's not much access like that, and even though the property butts up to the back of Matheson State Park, there's little opportunity for access there other than perhaps trails and things like that.
So it sounds like lots of work for you. I know you're going to be very busy, but thanks for giving us a little sense of what you guys are going to be dealing with as the parks expand. Carrie Novak is site superintendent for Starved Rock and Matheson State Parks. Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
Before we go, nearly 11 million Americans use e-cigarettes. Another way to term is vaping, and it's still less than the third. Still less than a third of the number of Americans who smoke regular cigarettes. But unlike regular cigarettes, e-cigarette sales are going up. They're also more popular among younger Americans. Here in Illinois, about 27% of high school seniors say they use e-cigarettes. There's a lot we don't know about the long-term effects of vaping, and we just wanted to end by talking a little bit about that because public officials have been raising concerns, whether it's the Illinois General Assembly. We talked about this yesterday, considering passing a bill that would raise the legal age of cigarette sales from 18 to 21. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, the federal FDA. Scott Hayes is with us. He's a senior research scientist at the Center for Prevention Research Development at the University of Illinois. He's also chair of Illinois' statewide tobacco planning committee. Scott, I wonder if we can just start with if we know if there's a difference chemically and health-wise between an e-cigarette versus a regular cigarette.
Yeah, I mean, one of the key differences between an e-cigarette and a regular cigarette is the smoking part of a cigarette versus vaping. And so the things that make a traditional cigarette combustible are not present in e-cigarettes, along with the tar that is present in the tobacco leaf. And the advantages there, there's a lot of toxins in the compounds that keep a cigarette burning, and the tar is actually one of the key compounds that causes a lot of the heart disease that a traditional cigarette creates by clogging the arteries and causing heart attacks, which is a key part of the deaths that result from traditional smoking.
And so we have a sense that we think that e-cigarettes are less harmful, but to be clear, there's still harmful effects of this.
That's very true. And the reason for that is that the key chemical compound in cigarettes is nicotine, and that compound is present in e-cigarettes and in many ways in higher concentrated doses, or at least potentially higher concentrated doses in an e-cigarette or a vaping device or any what we call electronic nicotine delivery systems.
And so when we think about the discussion about regulations, as it stands right now, do you think that cities, states, the U.S. is properly regulating the use and sale of e-cigarettes or vaping devices?
There are many things that can be done, particularly for e-cigarettes. One of the key things is when the state of Illinois passed the law requiring public places to be smoke-free, e-cigarettes were not included in that law. And so now in almost all public places, including schools and many universities, they just haven't updated those codes to include e-cigarettes. And one of the key advantages to that smoke-free law is simply the modeling behavior of people using these devices. And when young people see people using these devices in malls, in restaurants, and in other places, they pick up that habit, thinking that this may be something that they want to do. And that's a key aspect of eliminating these things from that aspect of the state law.
And when we think about raising the age of cigarette sales from 18 to 21, which is something the legislature is considering right now in veto session, how important is something like that?
It's absolutely critical. Raising the age to 21 for all devices that deliver nicotine, whether they're smoke devices like cigarettes, pipes, cigars, and then vape devices or electronic nicotine delivery systems. The key aspect is the longer that a person can delay the onset of the use of any device that contains the chemical compound of nicotine, the longer they delay the possibility of addiction, the possibility of lifetime use, the possibility of harmful consequences for their physiology developing from nicotine. So this is really absolutely essential. And I think most proposals to raise the age include electronic nicotine delivery systems.
One last question for you,
yep.
Scott. I think that people often think that e-cigarettes can help them quit actual cigarettes. Is there any truth to that?
there is some truth to it. It has to be appropriately managed, and there's sort of rigorous discipline that goes along with that. The nicotine dosage is the most important thing, and making sure that dosage becomes reduced over a period of time. In many ways, those nicotine dosage, I was just at a store yesterday looking at Juul ad on the shelf. There's nothing on there about how the milligrams of nicotine content, that really needs to be front and center. And
oh, yes, so you don't even know.
That.
Wow.
We don't know. I mean, that's really a key.
Well, thanks for being with us. That's Scott Hayes. He's a senior research scientist at the U of I. He's also chair of the Illinois Statewide Tobacco Planning Committee. Scott, Professor Hayes, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to take a look at how teachers use technology and screens in the classroom. And you may have heard of an electric car company, Rivian. They've got a new plant in Normal. This week they're at the LA Auto Show. WGLT's Ryan Denham will join us live from there. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.